From Utah Public Radio, this is Undisciplined. I'm Matthew LaPlante. The Via Appia is among the oldest continuously used roads in the world, stretching all the way back to Appius Claudius Cacus, the Roman censor who oversaw the building of the first section of the road in 312 BC during the Samnite Wars. A few hundred years down the road, so to speak, Julius Caesar was appointed as the road's curator. And this and other roads that Caesar traveled on throughout his life are still around in many parts today. And a few years ago, the travel writer John Cahey had an idea. He'd journey over Caesar's roads, tracking the steps of the Roman general, statesman, author, and historian. Cahey traveled across Italy, North Macedonia, Greece, and Turkey, following along the Via Appia, the Via Traiana, and the Via Ignatia. And he wrote about those travels in his new book, Following Caesar. But this isn't just a story about Caesar. It's a story of the people who live along these roads, who Cahey has found eager to warmly embrace travelers who were following in the steps of their ancestors. John Cahey is the author of three other books about traveling in Italy, Sicilian Splendors, Hidden Tuscany, and Seeking Sicily. Before those books, he had a four-decade-long career in and around the business of journalism, including 22 years at the Salt Lake Tribune. And as a matter of full disclosure here, that's where we met, when John was an editor and I was a reporter, and we sometimes butted heads over matters so trivial that only a pair of passionate journalists could possibly care. John Cahey, welcome.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that, Matthew.
John, the thing a lot of us know about the Roman Empire, even if we know very little else, is that it was often at war. And that's what drove the building of roads like the Via Appia, which was built in the 300s BC, and the Via Ignatia, which was built in the 100s BC. These things all go back to war.
That's correct. And what's interesting to note is that soldiers often in between these wars, in between these battles, were the ones who built good portions of some of these roads. It was an army. They already had it in place and they already had all of that manpower. So why not? And of course, conquered peoples along the routes and that kind of thing were often used to complete the roads as well.
It was tough life being a soldier back then. You'd go to war and then you'd come home from war and instead of getting a break, you'd go to work building a road for the next war.
If you happen to survive, you might get some land. Your general, who might be a later consul for Rome during the Republican period, might be able to secure land for you in the conquered areas. The Via Appia was primarily built during the time when Rome as a republic was trying to take over the entire peninsula of what we know as Italy today. And that happens to be an important part. The Roman government originally said, no, we don't want to do that because our enemies will use these roads to get to us, just like we want to use them to get to them. But Appius prevailed, and there we have it.
And when we talk about building a road back then, what did that mean? I mean, how do you build a road back then? We know what roads look like today. There's, you know, this asphalt and concrete and all of this, but it was different back then.
Yes, it was a land that was full of forests, full of swamps, full of mountains, and they all had to be traversed and so forth. In the early days of the Roman Republic, it was just pathways. Armies had to make their way through swamps and that type of thing. And the roads that Appius began building, the Via Appia, it had to be built a little bit better than that, and he wanted it fairly straight. There are really straight portions of that road today that are remarkable to see with a modern highway over the top of it. And they had to be strong enough and built sturdily so that they didn't sink into the ooze of a swamp and that type of thing.
There's a belief that the Appia was built so straight because the people who were building it used the stars to guide them as they cut through these forests and swamps and hillsides.
That's right. There's a couple of stars that we call Castor and Pollux, and they're named after Roman gods. And at the time, 312 BC, Castor and Pollux were in a different position in the sky above Italy as they are today. Everything shifts around eventually if you wait long enough. And these early road builders used very basic instruments to focus on those two stars, at least in the early segments of the road. And it was one of the ways they encouraged soldiers to work hard on the road, is because they were doing this in favor of the gods. So Castor and Pollux were quite important as stars, as gods, in the construction of the Via Appia.
And the Via Appia very quickly becomes not just practical for the movement of armies, but people began using these roads for other purposes as well.
That's right. They became commercial roads, but you might have to have a specific permit in order to use it if the army wasn't in need of it right away. And they might have been toll roads at different times. And the general public would not be allowed on it at different times. And then there are times when they would. And every so often, a few miles apart, there were way stations and places where people could pay tolls and where people could stay and rest after a day's journey along these roads. And these way stations became small villages and grew into large villages and became the cities we see in southern Italy today.
And so if you're someone who is interested in accumulating power, one of the ways you might do that is to take charge of a road. And lo and behold, along comes this guy, Julius Caesar, about a century before Christ. Do we know how he came to become the curator of the Via Appia?
He did not come from a family that was originally in power. He was a rather ordinary appearing young man who probably in his late 20s knew important people. His family knew important people, even though they didn't have a lot of power or money themselves. He was not wealthy, but he did have a certain amount of cash at hand. He was ambitious, of course, as we know Caesar was, and he was able to finally secure this position as a stepping stone to higher authority. He would eventually become a consul to Rome, which is one of the annual leaders. You were elected for a one-year term, unless, of course, the Republic was in crisis, and then you could be picked as a dictator for a year at a time, but not permanently. And he wanted to take those steps. And that's what he did. He was able to secure that position. And there's a whole way of how he built support for himself along that road because he was the curator.
As Julius Caesar became powerful, his life's trajectory, his decisions, his movements across the empire become really guided by these roads that he helped build and then he later traveled. Talk a little bit about what Caesar as a ruler used these roads for.
Well, he would move armies along them as his predecessors did in the earliest roads. Let's say he was going to the east. After he had conquered Gaul, his former son-in-law, Pompey, was a ruler in Rome and was very ambitious himself. And he was Caesar's son-in-law. He had married Caesar's daughter. And it was one of those, wasn't a marriage of convenience. It certainly unified the two together, but it was a marriage of true love. Pompey and Julia really loved each other. Well, Julia died after childbirth. And that took Pompey out of Caesar's family. And the two eventually, after being good friends and really quite liking each other, bumped heads. And Caesar crossed the Rubicon, came into Rome, the Roman area with his army, and civil war began between him and Pompey. And they chased each other back and forth to the east into Macedonia across the Adriatic. using these roads to move their armies.
There's a great scene in the book where you're sitting on this little humble bench thinking about this relationship, this fight between Caesar and Pompey. I mean, it's 2,000 years in the past, and yet it still felt visceral to you as you were traveling across, in this case, Italy, exploring these roads that these rulers once used to fight against each other. Because a lot of those roads, parts of them are still there.
Yes, and this spot that you're referring to was in Brindisi. And I was sitting there looking out into the bay, which then opens up into the Adriatic. And Caesar was in great siege with Pompey. Pompey occupied the city and was boarding ships with his army to go east. And there they would battle with each other. But Caesar had caught up to him. Pompey got into the city before Caesar arrived. And it was fascinating to sit in the spot where the army must have been massed at the end. It was actually within a few hundred feet where that bench was, which was the end of the road, the Via Appia. And of course, across the water, the Via Ignatia began, that then went all the way towards what we know today as Constantinople, but was then called Byzantium.
There's this experience that historians have a lot, I think, where they find themselves in just the most peaceful of places, like that little bench, right? Just thinking back to decisions that changed the world through a lot of force and violence. This is the story of these roads across the former Roman Empire.
Yeah, you know, what strikes me is that one person can make a decision that by following that decision and having a victory, say, or even having a loss, and whatever the fruits of that decision or the bad things that come from that decision, it changes the course of history. One of the people who used portions of the Via Appia and so forth was Hannibal. He was in Italy for 17 years, you know, crossing the Alps with his elephants and so forth. And he made his way south. And he took his army across portions of the Via Appia. And one of the great bits of history is that Hannibal did not besiege Rome. He had a general who wanted him to, but Hannibal refused. He did not want to. And if he would have taken Rome, the city of Rome, the Romans would have lost that whole episode dramatically. And history as we know it today would have a basis in Carthaginian history rather than Roman Western history. And what would our cultures be? What would Europe be like today? It's an interesting question. One person can make a snap decision or a well-thought-out decision and change history forever.
You know, I'm often quite amazed that we know so much about where different rulers were at different times in their lives, when different events were happening, all these 2,000 years ago. This is important to the way that you decided to take your trip as you traveled these roads. Early in the book, you come upon a passage from the poet Horace, who writes about taking the Appian Road, leaving Great Rome for Aricia, where he found a modest inn. And so I love this, John. That's what you did. You left Great Rome, you went to Aricia, and you found a modest bed and breakfast. And that's how you started.
Yes, Ed, this always fascinates people when they ask me how I plan a book or whatever. And I sort of knew where I was going to start from. I had read Horace. I had read his journey. I decided I would make that journey of his sort of a theme along the road. He was on his way for a diplomatic mission, and he had several people with him. And this diplomatic mission eventually included people who are well known to us today, famous people. And they were on a mission to try to bang out a treaty between Octavian, who took over after Caesar was killed, and his grandnephew, Octavian, who became Augustus. And this was to create a treaty where these two men could agree to get along better than they were. And he stayed at that inn, and I went into the town and through Airbnb got one that was probably within a very short distance of where he stayed. And that town is right on the Via Appia. And I followed him all the way down to Brindisi. And it was a snap decision, quite frankly, an unplanned for journey other than I had the general goal in mind, get from point A to point B and see what's along the way and take your time. But as far as an outline for the book, I never did one. It just happened as I went along, meeting people who could help me and so forth.
There's a real Blanche DuBois kind of attitude toward, or maybe approach toward the way you did this, right? This I've always depended on the kindness of strangers. You plant yourself in these places, and then you just start doing this thing that is, I mean, quite frankly, John, it doesn't happen very much anymore. People have lost this skill to just go around and start asking people if they know or they know other people who can tell you about the history of the place that you're in and the history, in this case, of this road. And what I love about this, John, is that it works for you. I mean, like, people start coming out of the woodwork. You meet someone who tells you about someone else who tells you about someone else. There's not all this pre-planning that I think is so much more common now and takes away the serendipity of a lot of the adventures that you had along this trip.
Yes, I mean, it's like when you and I were young reporters and something would happen and an editor would say, go out and knock on doors.
Right.
And talk to people and find out what they know about this. And we would do it, sometimes frustrated that we had to do stuff like that because people would slam doors in our face. But on this trip and on the previous trips for my books, I take a chance. I send a message to the host of the place where I'm going to stay. And maybe I might be staying in that place for, oh, let's say 5 days. Anywhere from 3 to 5 days, and in some places like Brindisi, I stayed longer. And I would send a message to the host, and I would say, do you know anybody who knows anything about the Via Appia? I'm an author. I'm writing a book. And 9 times out of 10, they knew somebody. And they knew somebody who was responsible and really knew real history. And this just all fell into place all along, whether it was in Italy or North Macedonia or Greece or Turkey. It just all fell into place that way. And it amazes me, too, that that's how it can happen.
This is the way you meet a guy who turns out to be one of the highlights of your trip. His name was Roberto Polino. He's a geologist who studied the Via Appia. You found this guy simply because you mentioned your project to a host in San Nazaro. Tell me about your time with Roberto.
It was an incredible day. We met at dinner. My host took me to his town, which was right on the Via Appia. And we met at this restaurant. A woman was there who was a friend of theirs who they asked if she would be sort of an interpreter. She spoke good English. They did not. My host in San Lazaro did not speak English. Roberto did not speak English. And so she joined us, and I treated everybody to a really nice meal, and we had a great conversation. We talked about what I was doing and the road and so forth. And Roberto says, meet me tomorrow at my place, which was just an apartment right on Via Appia, the modern road that covered the ancient road. And he said, meet me at my place, and I'll take you on a journey. And it was around what used to be called Benevento. Well, it's called today Benevento, which back in Roman times was Beneventum. And he took me in that area all around Benevento, and we saw wonderful things.
Most of the guidebooks and history books that talk about the Via Appia suggest that it ends at the Roman columns on Brindisi. But you came to believe that that might not actually be the case.
That's true, and it was a surprise to me, but it was a logical thing that I learned. Yeah. When I went to Brindisi, I didn't have my host there did not know anybody who could help me. I went in there cold. And my very first morning, I had followed the Via Appia all the way from Tarento, which is on the inside of the heel, to the outside of the heel, which is on the Adriatic, Brindisi, and into the city and into the place that I had reserved. And I went, my first morning, I went to the museum there, a great archaeological museum. And while I was paying for my ticket, the two people at the front desk were there, and I said, do you guys know anybody? And they thought for a minute, and they said, well, we know this guide, and he speaks English. And they called him on the phone right there, and I talked to him. They handed me the phone, and he says, I'll meet you tomorrow morning. This fellow turned out to be one of my best friends in the whole journey. He spent 4 or 5 days with me. Oh, he only charged me for that first day tour of 2 hours. And then because he was an archaeologist by training, and he was working as a guide, and he had incredible archaeological background.
This poor guy was just waiting for somebody like you to come along so that he could bend your ear about all the stuff he knew about the Via Appia.
That's right. Danny, he was Daniele, but everybody called him Danny, just like we would in English. He was remarkable.
And Danny tells you that he's come to believe that even though there's these very impressive Roman columns at the supposed end of the road, that if you stand there and really think about it, there's almost no way logically that that's actually the marker of the end of the road.
It tops out on a hillside that overlooks, covered with modern trappings, you know, pavements and stairs and parks and that kind of thing. But it overlooks the bay of Brindisi and the Adriatic. And the reality is that those markers are of a later time, a medieval period in history, long after the Romans and their times there. And a road would just not end abruptly on the brow of a hill, because this road theoretically would have gone down to the edge of the sea, to the edge of the harbor. And he pointed the construction of the pillars and said, you know, you see this is medieval, this is so forth and so on. And about 150 feet to the east of that spot, where the Via Appia logically would have come down, they know where it ran through the city at, and where it logically would have come down would have been the end of the road. But tradition and so forth is, and legend and so forth is what drives a lot of things. And everybody came to think that that's where the road ended, was at those columns, but it wasn't. And he pointed that out, and he showed me things in that town and outside of that town where portions of the roads was newly uncovered, where portions of another road, the Via Traiana, existed. And there were structures left that nobody ever visits because they just, it's not in a guidebook. They just don't know it's there. And he knew where all of this was, like Roberto did.
And you wouldn't know these things unless you did what you did, John, right? To stop and to talk to people and to spend time with them and ask them questions and do all of these things that you learned to do over a long career as a journalist.
Well, you can't write a book, a responsible book, by just reading things like a responsible travel narrative, let's say, simply by reading somebody's guidebook. Because these things that I saw, most of these things that I saw, are not in a guidebook. And it takes finding people who know about them to actually be able to see it, to take a photograph that can appear in the book. There's just no way you can do it without other people who know. And finding them is part of the wonderful exercise that I've gone through with 6 books.
That's John Cahey, He's a veteran journalist and a travel writer, and his latest book is Following Caesar, From Rome to Constantinople, The Pathways That Planted the Seeds of Empire. John Cahey, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Undisciplined is a production of Utah Public Radio, and if you happen to live in Utah, you can listen to us on UPR every Thursday morning at 10:30. If you miss us, then you can listen to every episode of Undisciplined wherever you get your podcasts. Our program is supported by a generous donation from the College of Humanities and Social Sciences at Utah State University and from listeners like you. You can support our work at donate.nprstations.org/UPR. Our producer is Nicholas Porath. Our theme music is Little Idea by Benjamin Tissot. And I'm Matthew LaPlante. Thanks for listening. Now go have big ideas.